Look, everyone. Well, thank you very much for coming to this Socialist Party Day School. Some good number of you, which is quite nice to see. The Day School today is dedicated to Marx. As socialists, we have a debt to Marx, and in particular to two of Marx's principal theories, the labour theory of value and the materialist conception of history. So we've got two speakers today, one of whom will be speaking on economics, which is this lecture now you're about to hear now, and one on historical materialism. We're starting now with a talk on Marx and economics. Darrell Poynton has agreed to step in at the last minute. So without further comment, I will pass you over to him.
Thanks for having me. Economics, or political economy, as it used to be called, is the study of how men and society choose, with or without the use of money, to employ scarce productive resources, which could have alternative uses, to produce various commodities over time, and distribute them for consumption now and in the future, among various people and groups in society. This is a quote from Paul Samuelson, who is a author of many best-selling economics textbooks. So, according to this definition, economics used to be called political economy. So, the only difference between these two things should be the name only, not the subjects that they cover. Now, economic theoretician and historian I.I. Rubin had this definition of political economy. Political economy deals with human working activity, not from the standpoint of its technical methods and instruments of labour, but from the standpoint of its social form. It deals with productive relations which are established amongst people in the process of production. So, by this definition, political economy is not the ahistorical study of the allocation of scarce resources, but it's a study of social relations, of culture. As Freddie Perlman said, political economy asks why the productive forces of society develop within a particular social form, why the machine process unfolds within the context of business enterprise, why industrialisation takes the form of capitalist development. Political economy asks how the working activity of people is regulated in a specific historical form of economy. That's what Freddie Perlman said. So economics, as it is known today, has its roots in what became known as the marginalist revolution of the late 19th century and early 20th century. Its theorists sought to build a theory based more closely on the mathematical models of the physical sciences. And they were sort of sought to downplay the importance of the historical and social factors. In the late 19th century, coinciding with the publication of a textbook called Economics by Alfred Marshall, the term economics came to replace political economy. So what is taught as economics today has its roots in these theories rather than the more broadly social and historically based works of people like Adam Smith, Ricardo and John Stuart Mill. Now, the stated aim of Marx in his study of society is stated in the preface of Capital. He says his aim was to lay bare the economic law of motion of modern society. He goes on further to say, to describe his method, in the analysis of economic forms, neither microscopes nor chemical agents are of use. The force of abstraction must replace both. Here individuals are dealt with only insofar as they are personifications of economic categories, embodiments of particular class relations and class interests. My standpoint, from which the evolution of the economic formation of society is viewed as a process of natural history, can less than any other make the individual responsible for relations whose creature he socially remains, however much he may subjectively raise himself above them. The physicist either observes physical phenomena where they occur in their most typical form, a most free form, disturbing influence, or wherever possible, he makes experiments under conditions that assume the occurrence of the phenomena and its normality. In this work, I have to examine the capitalist mode of production and the conditions of production and exchange corresponding to that mode. So, Marx's project, it's not really a work of economics, where through a series of increasingly more complex equations you're trying to arrive at an accurate theory of price. Instead, it's a work of political economy, or more precisely, it's a critique of political economy, where he seeks to investigate the material, social and historical reasons that explain why modern society is organised in the way it is today. The method used by Marx is commonly referred to as either historical materialism or dialectical materialism. Now, these terms don't originate from Marx himself, but from Engels and Plekhanov, respectively. These terms can be slightly misleading in the fact that it wasn't the intention of Marx to create some kind of super-historical theory of history, which can be applied to all eras of historical existence. It's not to say Marx did not have a method, but I won't dwell on Marx's method too much because that could take up another talk, really. Rosalind Wallach Below, I guess is how you pronounce her name, gives us an interesting formulation of Marx's method in her book Dialectical Phenomenology. I would have reworded this a bit in a bit sort of less academic language if I had time, but bear with me. So, rule one, treat concepts as grounded in a historically specific form of life or mode of production. So, concepts are the way in which we appropriate the world as a totality. However, concepts are not the product of a mind that is outside of or independent of the world. Although the world as a totality is produced by analysis, the real world and its relations do exist concretely before analysis. Marx states that concepts can never exist other than as an abstract, one-sided relation within an already given concrete living whole. Rule two, treat individuals as grounded in a historically specific form of life or mode of production. According to this rule, one resists treating individuals' decisions, intentions or characteristics as the grounds of action. Rather, one treats individuals' decisions, intentions and characteristics as grounded in and having sense in terms of a form of life. It treats individual acts as made possible or intelligible by a form of life which they presuppose. Rule three, according to Rosalind Below, is treat a form of life as a totality of internal relations. A form of life as a totality of internal relations then refers to the relations that are necessary for the production of the object that one studies. The relations are internal to its process of production. This differs from treating a social formation as everything that can be collected as existing within a particular historical period or within particular boundaries. Thus, the form of life that Marx analyses is conceived as a totality of the subjective, objective conditions for the production of capital. And rule four, treat a concrete form of life as contradictory. Now, this is kind of referring to dialectics. This rule constitutes the principle of growth. A concrete form of life is a result of a self-contradictory movement, a subjectivity that is divided into opposing moments. A contradictory form of life is a totality of opposing moments, moments that negate each other. So that's something I pulled out of a book by Rosalind Below. Perhaps this can be summed up a little bit more pithily by Engels in the preface to Capital Volume 3, where he says it would be wrong to look into Marx for fixed, cut-and-dried definitions that are valid for all time. It should go without saying that where things and their mutual relations are conceived not as fixed, but rather as changing in their mental images too, i.e. concepts, are also subject to change and reformulation. That they are not to be encapsulated in rigid definitions, but rather in their process of historical or logical formulation. Okay, so bear all that in mind, and now I'll try to give you a very brief and sort of fleeting thumbnail sketch of Marx's value theory. So Marx begins his inquiry with an analysis of the commodity. He does this because the commodity is the economic cell form of the capitalist mode of production. The internal relations of the commodity contain, in a germ-like state, the relations of commodity-producing society as a whole. Now, it gives some definitions in the first few chapters of Capital. So it defines a commodity as any useful product of human labour that is produced to be exchanged. And he says it has both a use value, in that it can be put to fulfil a certain use, and that it has a value, in that it embodies a certain amount of society's labour time. Now, the term use value doesn't refer to the amount of usefulness that an object can provide, and it's not a term of moral judgment. So, for instance, an atom bomb is as much a use value as a potato or something like that. Now, value, it's only visible through exchange value, through the ratios at which different commodities exchange in the marketplace. So, as I've said, all commodities are the product of a certain amount of human labour time, and it is this which gives commodities their intrinsic value. So, this is the thing we compare when we're comparing commodities against each other to exchange them. So, commodities that take more labour to create have a higher value than ones that take less. And as labour becomes more productive, as it becomes easier to produce things, their value falls. But value is not determined by the actual amount of private labour that it takes to produce a commodity, but by the amount of socially necessary labour time needed to reproduce it, by the average social time. There's a little example I've copied here, I'll just read out. Let's say the average widget maker takes 1 hour to make a widget. The social average is the social value of the commodity, the amount of time society requires to make a widget. But I'm old and slow. I take 3 hours. This is my individual value. My individual value is higher than the social value. But that doesn't mean that I can sell my widget for more. I must sell it at the social average. Marx calls this the socially necessary labour time. In this case, the determination of social value is made not by my individual labour time, but by the average social productivity of society. If the socially necessary labour time changes due to changes in production and productivity, then the individual value and social value will change too. Supply is determined by the total amount of labour that goes into making widgets and the productivity of that labour. But when we go to the widget factory to work, we do not know how much labour as a whole society is devoting to making widgets. There could be a million other people making widgets or only a few. We only learn how much labour society has put into widget making when we enter the market to compare the products of our labour with the rest of society. If too much labour goes into widget making, then there is an oversupply of widgets. The social value falls below their individual value. If not enough work has gone into widgets, there is an undersupply and their social value rises above their individual value. This fluctuation of social value around individual value is what allows labour to be apportioned. So, I don't know how clear that example was, but perhaps questions at the end. So, intrinsic value is, it's not something hidden deep inside the commodity, some sort of physical substance we could measure or observe if we had the right tools. But it's a social relation, and it's one we can only observe through exchange value at the ratios where commodities exchange. It appears, and so instead of being appearing as a social relation, it appears as a relation between objects. This is what Marx is referring to when he speaks of the fetishism of commodities. Since all goods have been turned into commodities and access to non-commodified materials restricted, those without the means of producing anything to exchange must sell the only thing they have, that is their capacity to work and bring themselves back to work the next day. We call this their labour power. So capitalist society is a society of classes. On the one hand, you have the capitalists, those who use their monopoly on the productive wealth, which is factories, raw materials and land, etc., to create more wealth. And on the other hand, you have the workers who have to sell their labour power in order to subsist. Capitalist production is not only production for exchange, it's production for profit. So at the beginning of the process, the capitalist has a certain amount of money with which they purchase their means of production and labour power. At the end of the cycle, the original sum of money plus a profit is returned. But where does this extra wealth, the profit, come from? At first sight, it might look like profits come from buying cheap and selling dear. And, this might be true in individual cases, but it doesn't explain the total expansion of society's wealth as a whole. When we're exchanging things, we're just moving them around. So when something is sold for more than it is worth, this transaction hasn't added to the total wealth of society. It's just merely altered the distribution of wealth. So to understand where profit comes from, we have to turn our attention away from exchange and towards production. So just with all other commodities, the value of labour power is determined by the amount of socially necessary labour time necessary to produce it. The value of labour power is therefore equal to the value of the commodities, such as training, food and shelter, etc., necessary to produce and reproduce the worker at their current standard of living. The actual value that labour power may produce during the production process has no bearing on the value of labour power itself. So, in order to produce, the capitalist must purchase means of production, which in Marx's work these are called constant capital, and labour power, which is known as variable capital. Once the production cycle is complete, the capitalist hopes to recoup these costs plus an extra amount on top, which we call this extra amount surplus value. The value of constant capital is returned to the capitalist at a steady rate. The value of a machine is returned over its life cycle of so many years, for example. Its input value is fixed once it has been purchased and used up in the production process. Constant capital does not add new value to the commodity, but transfers its value to the commodity bit by bit. So I've got another example here, which if $1 million machine is used to produce 10,000 cars in the course of a year before it's worn out and needs to be replaced, then effectively every car has $100 worth of machine in it. So variable capital, if it is used wisely by the capitalist, can add new value to the product. This is done by getting the labourer to work longer than the period needed to create a value equal to the cost of their labour power. So, for example, let us suppose that the worker earns 100 euros and consumes 1,000 euros worth of materials and components to produce a product which is sold for 1,300 euros. So this value can be represented as constant capital, which is the means of production of 1,000, variable capital, which is wages of 100, plus a surplus value of 200. That 200 of surplus value was added to the product solely by the activity of the worker. Of these sums of values, it is only the variable capital which expands. So, in order to increase the amount of surplus labour, the capitalist has a number of options. Firstly, they can strive to increase the length of the working day, or they could seek to decrease the amount of time necessary for labour to be reproduced. Now, they can either do this by raising productivity through the use of technology and other methods. They can increase the intensity of labour, or they can seek to decrease the amount of wages in proportion to profits. Now, against all these things, the workers are seeking to increase the value of their labour power, or to at least maintain it. So this explains the fundamental antagonism of interest between capitalists and workers. The more surplus value the capitalist extracts from his workers, the better he is at being a capitalist. The better the working class can resist this exploitation, the more they can defend their own interests. It's this antagonism which lies at the heart of the way that value is created in a capitalist society. So, labour power is therefore a very special commodity, and it's the only one which produces more value than it costs to purchase. It's through labour power only that surplus value is created. So, without the purchase of labour power, the accumulation of capital would be impossible. Now, in the capitalist system, capitalists are in competition with each other over profits. So I'll just briefly kind of talk about this. So as we've seen, in order to increase the amount of surplus value or profits coming to them, the capitalist must strive to increase the productivity of labour power. Increased productivity has the effect of lowering the value of commodities, since less labour time is required to produce them. If an enterprise adopts a new production technique, which allows them to produce commodities at a rate that is below the socially necessary average labour time, they will have a competitive advantage. They can sell the commodity cheaper than their competitors and yet still make a profit, or they can sell at the same price as their competitors and make super profits. But in order to remain competitive and profitable, their competitors have to adopt this new technique also. Once all the competitors have done this, the socially necessary average is now reduced across the whole board. So instead of originally being a means of gaining a competitive edge, the new technique is now necessary for just standing still, for remaining in business. It is this never-ending need to improve production techniques that creates the dynamic of capitalism. In order to simply stand still, the capitalist must reinvest the majority of their surplus value. Without keeping pace of developments in machinery and technological advances, the capitalist would go out of business and cease to be a capitalist. In this sense, then, capitalism can be seen as a system not for the enrichment of individuals, but as a system for the never-ending accumulation of capital for its own sake. Now, Marx had a theory of a crisis in the capitalist society. The whole work of Marx is in an incomplete form, though, so this is kind of a rough rule of thumb which I'm going to go through. But so in primitive societies, where production is not yet market-dependent, crises take the form of disease, pestilence, famine, and natural disasters. But in capitalist societies, crisis tends not to be caused by nature. For the most part, we can store enough surpluses to protect us against the ravages of the elements. But capitalist crises occur when the market mechanisms that regulate the distribution of labour break down. This is not because of some external influence which disrupts an otherwise balanced system, but because of the internal contradictions of capital, which periodically present and resolve themselves through crisis. It is not so much a problem of man against nature as a problem of man against man. So capitalists throw their money into circulation in order to have it returned as a profit. When there are no profitable avenues of investment to be found, the productive cycle freezes up. Commodities pile up in warehouses, debts cannot be paid, and economic activity comes to a grinding halt. As a result of the competitive struggle for profits, capitalists must invest more and more in the technological apparatus of production. The effect is to reduce capital's dependence on labour. Tasks require less labour to complete, and a general de-skilling takes place, making it easier to lay off workers and to decrease their ability to resist. The ratio of variable to constant capital decreases, but as variable capital is also the source of surplus value, a fall in the rate of profit occurs. Capital goes looking for a profit, but can't find enough places for profit because it has annihilated its own ability to create value. Crisis can only be overcome by the devaluing of capital. Now, this is done by selling off commodities cheaply, by laying off workers, shutting down factories, dropping property prices, and, well, in effect, having a bargain basement clear out of capital that's been over-accumulated. Some capitalists do not survive this purge, but some do, and those that do will be able to buy the assets of their former competitors at knock-down prices, thus fueling the next round of accumulation. The tendency of the rate of profit to fall does not mean that profit rates are on a continual downward slope towards zero. Instead, it means that we can expect a period of falling profit rates before the onset of a crisis, and then a restoration of them once a sufficient amount of capital has been devalued. There are also countervailing tendencies which can have the effect of lessening or even cancelling out the fall in profit. These include attempting to depress wages below the value of labour power by cheapening the elements of constant capital, that's by cheapening the factories and productive machinery, and by opening new markets and through continual technological innovation. So, in conclusion, I mean, what all I've given you here is a very incomplete and fleeting glimpse at some aspects of Marx's theory of value. The modern editions of the Grundrisse Critique of Political Economy and the three volumes of Capital take up about 4,000 pages. So, I mean, all I can hope to give you here is just a very brief starting point. By studying capitalism, we can learn that human society is not the result of some eternal logic or divine laws, but that it is created through our own actions as we produce and use the things we use every day. Once we can begin to answer how and why society works in the way it does, we're already some way towards understanding what can be done to change it. Thank you very much, Thomas.